So maybe a first question would be, give us a state of just your tribes. Madison has just been designated in December, Truax Field, as the home of F35A. Doctor, can you start? Give us an overview. Congressman Mike Gallagher of Green Bay was just elected to his second term in the U.S. House. He represents the 8th Wisconsin District. It's a very interesting time to be in Washington. So, Congressman Gallagher, thanks for stopping in the Wisconsin Eye office.
Thanks for having me. In studio. This is an honor.
In the studio. Thank you very much. You just started your second term. I consider the first term a learning, even though you were a staffer. Mm-hmm. How broken is Washington?
It's broken. It's fundamentally broken. And I think it's important to understand why and how it's broken. So a lot of this has deep roots, but really the origin of the modern dysfunction starts in the 70s. You had a series of attempts by Congress to claw back authority from the executive branch, all of which produced the exact opposite effect. So, for example, the War Powers Resolution, yes, intended to claw back authority from the executive branch on foreign policy, effectively put our war-making authority on autopilot and gave the president more power. By the way, passed over Nixon's veto. A lot of Watergate babies came into Congress in response to the Watergate scandal. 1974 Budget Control and Impoundment Act, intended to claw back authority from the executive branch, produced a dysfunctional budget process that's been broken ever since. 1976 Emergencies Act, you may have heard about that recently, intended to claw back authority.
February 26th, you voted against.
Indeed, and we can get to that. But the point I would make is, starting in the 70s, accelerating again in the 90s, two things have happened. Power has gone from Article 1, Congress, the legislative branch, and it has been surrendered to the executive branch. So the institution has become more powerless. And then power within the institution has gone from the committees and the individual members and has become tightly concentrated at the top. So you have a very small number of people that are making all the decisions. They control what bills come to the floor. And so as a result, you're left with two options as a member of Congress now. Rather than channeling your ambition and your energy into legislative work, you can either, one, play the long game, yeah, and raise money. And so hopefully one day, 20 years from now, you too could be subcommittee chair of whatever.
20 years. Is that the window to get real power?
Maybe I'm exaggerating a little bit, but I mean, how long has Nancy Pelosi been in Congress? I mean, how long does it generally take to ascend to the vaunted heights of leadership in the House?
Point well made, yes.
Yeah. Or two, and I think this is actually more destructive, because people feel like they can't make a difference through the legislative process. Instead, they are trying to become famous. They're trying to use their office as a way to get social media followers or to one day be a Fox News or an MSNBC host. And so it has become theater. It has become sort of performance art as instead of substantive political and legislative activity.
So either you play the long game, hoping to be a leader in, okay, let's say 18 years.
Yeah.
I'm not accepting your 20.
Okay.
Or
somewhere between 10 and 20.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. You use it as a stepping stone to some big Fox News contract or MSNBC contract.
I think there's another dynamic, too, where it's like, everyone in the House wants to be in the Senate, and the fundamental problem with the Senate is everyone wants to be president. So I would be in favor of a constitutional amendment that said no senator would be allowed to run for president while they're in office. But so listen, we've always had ambitious people. We've always had a mix of people in Congress. But what is new in the present day, I believe the framers and the founders never would have anticipated, is that the most powerful branch of government, according to the Constitution, the legislature.
Legislative branch.
Power would be uninterested in maintaining its power and would be careless in surrendering its power. And so we have to rectify that. I have some thoughts on how to do that. But until we claw back that authority, until we get Congress kind of operating more in a normal and more boring fashion, and people just doing their basic legislative job as opposed to spending all their time fundraising and throwing bombs on TV, the players may change. The jerseys may change, but we're going to get the same results.
Okay, wave a wand and fix it. One, two, or three ways that you would fix it?
Three ways.
Congress relevant again.
So I'll start from boring to more interesting. So one, you have to completely simplify and change the committee structure, right? As opposed to this divide between authorizing and appropriating committees, you have to take the appropriations committees, you have to collapse it into authorizing committees, and you have to simplify the committees so that they don't overlap and they aren't able to do oversight over the executive branch. So that's number one. That way you would make the work of each individual committee more meaningful. You'd make each committee more powerful. Mm-hmm. Number two, you got to get power from leadership down to the individual committees. Now that you've made the committees more common sense, more powerful, make the incentives make sense. So how do you do that? As opposed to committee chairs being elected by the steering committee, which is effectively the speaker, the majority leader, the most powerful people, make the committee chairs elected by the members of the committee. So they would have to respond to the ideas of their junior members. And if you're an ambitious junior member, you realize your path to power is improving yourself to be a productive citizen of that committee. The third thing I would do, which would just sort of transform, I think, the entire dynamic in DC, is to institute term limits. We have a bipartisan term limits bill right now. It would be 12 years in the House, 12 in the Senate. It would start with my class and phase in over time. So everyone that's been there for a while can stay there, yeah. Just sort of naturally expire over time. So term limits, I think, would go a long way towards telling the American people this isn't about careerism. It's not about getting rich. By the way, I would also support getting rid of lobbying for former members, not allowing it. Getting rid of congressional pensions.
And the revolving door.
Exactly. So that third bucket would just be get at careerism and cronyism and sort of drain the swamp. And that.
Are you the only one thinking like this?
No, I think there is that this new class. So my class had a lot of younger folks, a lot of military folks, a lot of people from different backgrounds. This, I was the second youngest member in the last Congress. Now I'm not even in the top 10 anymore because the class that just came in has a lot of new people that are trying to disrupt the status quo.
On your team, the R team, or just the
both.
Dem team?
Because
we hear
actually.
About the AOCs and, maybe we'll get there later.
Both. I mean, we got great new veterans in Congress. We just started this four-country caucus. Mike Waltz is one of the co-chairmen of it, a great veteran. The first Green Beret, I think, elected to Congress, I'm getting that correct. Dan Crenshaw, a Navy SEAL who lost his eye while deployed in defense of this country. We got a lot of young people with great experience that they bring to bear in Congress, and they recognize the same fundamental point. It's that business as usual is not getting the job done in D.C.
Okay, but when the Young Turks in the House Democrats nailed that encyclical to Speaker Pelosi's door, she said was, I'll be gone in, what, 2 or 4 years? They didn't carry the day.
Yeah.
So are you hopeful that this new energy, the new youthful enthusiasm that you obviously display can make an effective change? Because it seems to me that bright people like you ain't going to be around.
Sure.
4 or 5 terms from now, unless it changes.
Sure. Well, listen, I would say this. Yes, so Pelosi made a big show of agreeing to a bunch of rules changes, some of which I thought were good, but then she immediately violated all the rules. For example, we've now suspended the 72-hour rule, meaning you have to wait 72 hours before you introduce a bill so people don't vote on bills they haven't read, et cetera, et cetera. We violated it constantly, right? So I think that shows she's not serious about changing the institution because it would threaten her own power. But I will say this about that new crop of people coming in. One, I do believe they're genuine. It remains to be seen whether the swamp swallows them over time. However, every major period of congressional reform in the past, and Wisconsin actually has an interesting part in this history, the most successful period of reform in the modern era happened in the mid to late 40s, and it was led by Bob Follett Jr.
Right.
And they did a bit of this committee consolidation, which is a good model going forward. Every major period of reform has been preceded, whether it was the 40s, the 70s, or the 90s with the Gingrich reforms, was preceded by a period of profound disgust among the American people with how Congress is operating. And I would submit to you, we are at such a point. I mean, Congress has an 11% approval rating.
Yep.
So the American people are demanding this, and I think it's only a matter of time before Congress is forced to respond.
You had a front row seat in your first term watching what happened to Speaker Ryan. Between his interactions with President Trump, having to make some unusual rapprochement and deal with the Freedom Caucus.
Yeah.
Talk to me about the changes you saw in former Speaker Ryan, one of your comrades, over your first term.
Well,
did he get ground up?
Sausage? No. Okay, I'd say that there's a lot of conservatives who, were angry at Paul for this or that. I would tell you, every major conservative accomplishment over the last 2 years that conservatives are happy about right now, whether it's tax reform, whether it's the role Congress played in regulatory reform with the CRAs, take your pick, veterans reform, it would not have happened without Paul Ryan, particularly tax reform. That is the most difficult job in Washington, or maybe the second most difficult job in Washington. It is incredibly difficult to manage a big tent party like the Republican Party. So certainly, Paul had to deal with a difficult task, and herding cats, 250 some odd cats, all of whom think that they're the smartest person in the room,
right,
is an extraordinarily difficult job. But I would just submit to you that nothing would have been accomplished were it not for his leadership in
the
House.
What did the tax reform bill do to the national debt?
Certainly, it just depends on what growth projections you believe over the next 10 years.
What do you believe?
If I believe we could possibly sustain 3% growth over the next 10 years, but that's all other things being equal. The problem, as I see it, is few. One, we have a serious workforce challenge in Wisconsin,
yes,
and across the rest of the country.
Yes,
so businesses,
older,
as a result of tax, if businesses as a result of tax reform want to expand right now, and that's what I hear in my district, often they can't because people are the limiting factor. I've heard a version of this almost every single day in my district. We have 20 people come out for a job interview, 10 have the basic skills, 2 pass the drug test, and only one of the 2 is willing to show up for work. That's hard. That's a crisis. Certainly the ag industry without a workable immigration fix is struggling to get workers they need in a legal manner. The second thing I'd say is I think the tariffs, particularly the 232 tariffs, have been counterproductive, and that's holding back a lot of our economic potential right now. So while tax reform and regulatory reform have been positive, if we continue to get in this fight with our allies around the world, one, we're not going to be successful in getting tougher on China, and 2, we're going to be squeezing Wisconsin farmers and manufacturers economically precisely at the very moment they are ready to expand, and they're chomping at the bit to do that. The third thing I say is if you examine sort of the numbers so far, right, we've actually had increased revenues at the federal level. So that suggests there's something else going on here with expanding deficits.
Yes.
And that's what we've always known. It's that we have 70% of our spending is on autopilot. It's mandatory spending. It's Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and it's interest on the debt. If left unchecked, we're going to be spending more to service the interest on the debt in 5 years than we're spending on our Pentagon. And we won't have any money left over for all the nice things we want, right? Right now, we want to make an investment in infrastructure. We want to make an investment in any number of domestic priorities. At the same time, we want to continue this defense rebuild. But at some point, unless we want to tax the American people to a point where we're not going to grow economically, we're going to have to make some hard choices.
We have to deal with those entitlement programs, right?
At some point.
Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid.
So basically, this is largely a healthcare problem. I find it interesting that we spend 18% of our GDP as a country on healthcare, when the average among advanced industrialized countries is closer to 10%, and it's clear that we're not getting a better result for that money. Now, we tend to lead the world in innovation, and we have good access, and we have pretty good quality, but a lot of the major indicators are going in the wrong direction. Life expectancy is going down,
yes,
increased rates of not only physical health, but mental health disorders, suicide, depression. Everything is going in the wrong direction. I think we rank 31 of the 32 most advanced countries in the world. And so it's clear to me that the healthcare system right now is not delivering, despite the fact that we keep throwing more and more money at it. Incidentally, the military is struggling with the same thing. If you look at kind of the difference between the Reagan buildup versus the last 2 years of a military buildup, sure, our weapons systems have gotten more advanced and perhaps more expensive, but really the difference is the average cost of our servicemen and servicewomen, right? And that's a function of their healthcare costs and their retirement costs. And so we got to find a way to sort of really transcend the cost curve in healthcare. And one way I think we can do this, and it's something that neither party's really been talking about, is by focusing aggressively on price transparency in healthcare. In other words, I think both parties have gone amiss by focusing on the question of how we finance health insurance, as if the form of health insurance you have was the most important question. But if that insurance doesn't give you access to actual care, or if you can't comprehend a medical bill, then you're in a bad situation as a patient. And so I think by tackling the complexity of the system with radical price transparency, we can start to drive down costs, because ultimately insurance will reflect rising costs at the end of the day.
Do you wake up in the middle of the night scared of Medicare for All?
Yeah, I think
that might catch on, that the Bernie Sanders et al. And the young generation and young Democrats are going to sell that as an effective campaign theme as we elect the next president?
I do think so, and I think it's bad policy. For a variety of reasons. The cost of it is astronomical,
$32 trillion. Which is bigger than our debt of $22 trillion.
Exactly. But it's funny, I think the cost is so fantastical as to be almost overlooked, right? And I think it's lazy for people on my side of the aisle just to sit back and make fun of the proposal or make fun of the politicians on the other side of the aisle who have endorsed it without thinking through the implications. You have to do the. I think what we learned in our experience with healthcare over the last 2 years is that it's not enough just to be against something, right? In other words, we spent a lot of time criticizing Obamacare and not as much time thinking about, okay, what's our positive alternative, right? How do we fix this system, right? Because it's complex. I mean, health. I come from a family of physicians. My grandpa, my dad, my three uncles, my sister, they're all physicians in Wisconsin.
And they all have different opinions on how to fix it, right? Yeah.
Well, they all think they're the smartest person. In, I'm joking, physicians in my family. But it is so, so complex. And so it's not easy, but you have to do the hard work of thinking about a positive alternative, because we've seen our political environment right now is so volatile that who knows what is going to catch fire. And as outlandish as we think that may be, this stuff kind of tends to sneak up on you.
In your first term, your party controlled the U.S. House. Yeah. You were at the table when some of these big decisions were made. It flipped. Democrats now control the House. So your job has changed in a big way. Where's the joy when your party's out of power?
It certainly made things more difficult, but I might push back a little bit. I don't think my job has changed. In other words, I'm approaching my job this term the exact same way I did before. I think there's a tendency, related to what I said before, among some Republicans to say, okay, you're in the minority, just vote no on everything and criticize the other side. That's lame. People didn't send me back to Washington, D.C. for 2 years to sit back and, you know, mean tweet AOC, right? I think I owe it to the people of Northeast Wisconsin to work as hard as I can, even in an adverse environment where I know I'm sort of at a disadvantage in terms of votes, to see if I can get anything done. And take your most intractable issue. I don't care what it is. Healthcare is probably the most important issue from a numbers perspective and perhaps the most politically difficult issue.
If you get to foreign affairs, let's start with Afghanistan and
sure,
the Syria question.
Sure.
Go ahead.
My point is that, okay, it's probably going to be difficult for us to fix the healthcare system, this Congress and divided government, but there are meaningful pieces of that puzzle that you can pick out and start to solve. And so, for example, that price transparency effort I mentioned before,
yes,
I have a bipartisan bill with a Democrat from Colorado on that. And we're teeing up a whole host of other initiatives. And so I think you owe it to your constituents, even if you're in the minority, to still work as hard as you can to advance the ball down the field. And maybe you get singles and doubles and you don't get any home runs, but still, that's points on the board.
As opposed to sitting back and mean tweeting AOC.
less time on Twitter is always a good thing for everybody. Yeah.
Next shoe to drop in Washington, the Mueller report.
Yeah.
Are you scared from a constitutional standpoint, scared the threat it might pose to President Trump? Where are you on what might come forth next?
Well, the first thing I would say is I feel like every week for the last 3 months we've had a story saying this
week
the Mueller
week
report is going to drop.
I
find it hard to keep up with the whole thing. No, I think actually the untold story is the way in which the Constitution is effectively flexing its checks and balances muscles right now. So I don't think it's going to provoke a constitutional crisis. We'll see when the report comes out. Every day it seems to there's a story about, oh, Trump's going to try and, you know. So, no, I think we just voted overwhelmingly in the House to make the contents of the report public. So let's all hold our fire. Let's wait until it comes out. Let's unplug for a day, read it dispassionately, form our own independent opinions before we turn on the TV and have other people do our thinking for us, and then go from there. I don't think it's going to provoke a constitutional crisis.
Your February 26th vote against the presidential declaration of emergency dealing with the border money. Mm-hmm. Was that on the policy of immigration or an excessive abuse of presidential powers?
It was certainly not on the policy of immigration. Okay. I've consistently supported the president's proposals for border security, including the $5.7 billion proposal. I think the way in which the media and his opponents characterized it was actually shameful, because if you actually read the text of what the White House offered, it was a sophisticated proposal. It had 264 miles of physical border security, wall, fence, whatever you want to call it, mm-hmm, in areas where we need it, right? Areas where there's population-to-population contact on each side of the border. More rural areas, you can use technology, but it also had enhanced border patrol. More money into our immigration legal system, because really the crisis we have right now is that people are coming into our ports of entry, they're claiming asylum, and we don't have the resources to adjudicate those claims, so they get released, particularly if they have children with them, and oftentimes it takes between 2 to 7 years before they show back up, and it shouldn't surprise you to learn that sometimes they don't show back up at all. And so the other part of that proposal that I thought was very interesting and we should pursue is putting more resources in Mexico and then in Central America, in Nicaragua, Honduras, and other areas that are really having a collapse in government, so that we could adjudicate asylum claims there before caravans end up on our southern border. So That approach is right. I've supported it consistently. I've rejected the proposals on the other side. I think the fact that you have major Democratic presidential candidates right now saying it's not just a matter of opposing a wall, we need to tear down existing walls, tells you just how off the reservation that view is. Now, that being said, I voted against the emergency proposal because for years I criticized Obama for expanding the power of the presidency. And as we started off this conversation, I think the cancer at the heart of our Constitution is the expansion of executive authority, right?
Yep.
And so I can, in good conscience, if I want to retain any intellectual consistency, support that expansion just because it's the president of my party using it to pursue a policy that I actually support.
Do you think you'll be primaried as a result of that vote?
Who knows? But I never intended to get into politics. So if the worst that could happen to me is I get voted out of office, well, this has been an honor. Every single day I get to represent Northeast Wisconsin is an honor. So
talk about a primary. Do you think it would be in the best interest of your party if there was a primary challenger to President Trump?
I don't see that happening, quite honestly.
The governor of Maryland?
Oh, yeah, I've heard some rumors of that. Hogan? I don't know. I really find it hard to believe. I mean, when was the last time that's happened in a Republican incumbent or any incumbent president? I'm trying to think what the historical antecedent would be for that.
Johnson in the 60s. It may go back that far. I don't know.
I just find it hard to believe that that's going to happen.
You were in the Marine Corps for 2006, 2013, correct?
Mm-hmm.
You were an intelligence specialist.
Mm-hmm.
Where does the president get his intelligence on foreign affairs?
From what I understand,
law sources.
Well, I think him and Mike Pompeo have a very close relationship. I think an exceptionally close relationship. And so Pompeo, having transitioned from CIA director to Secretary of State, I think wields an enormous amount of influence in the White House, and I think they're very close. Quite frankly, I think the president has a very flat sort of advisory structure. So he's constantly calling everyone from members of Congress to people on the outside. And so I think it's fair to say that John Bolton does have a very big influence, but he also is at times competing with people like Rand Paul, who had the president's ear on foreign policy.
Do you respect Mr. Bolton on foreign affairs?
Oh, immensely.
Do you respect Mr. Pompeo?
I respect Mr. Pompeo immensely on foreign affairs. Absolutely. He's a very smart guy, Harvard educated, first in his class at West Point, military experience. I mean, the guy is incredibly smart. Now, I've had disagreements with both of them, for sure, on foreign policy. I've most recently disagreed with the administration signaling that it's going to get out of Syria without any plan, and same with Afghanistan. I think that would repeat some of the worst mistakes we've made over the last 8 years. And by the way, that's a bipartisan point of agreement in the House, and we've introduced some legislation to that effect to push back. And so, but I think the administration deserves enormous credit for some decisions they made, some tough decisions. For example, getting out of the Iran nuclear deal was absolutely the right decision. The decision to pursue a policy of maximum pressure with North Korea was the right approach. I hope we'll get back to that because I perceive in the last two summits we've actually gone backwards from that a few ways. The one big thing that Trump has gotten right on foreign policy, and it is the biggest thing, and it cannot be understated, is the priority of enemies we face. If you read the National Security Strategy and the National Defense Strategy, what they both say loud and clear is that our number one competitor is China. As the acting Secretary of Defense said, it's China, 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 right? Russia is a distant second. We are in an era of great power competition. And how we navigate this competition with China in particular will determine what the world is going to look like over the next 100 years. And I know there are good people, including people that I've deployed with in uniform, and I know quite well, that are working the China issue in the White House. And so they deserve credit for that.
When social media raises questions about the stability of the president, are you concerned about the president's emotional stability?
No, because it's all been overblown, I've seen constantly. Let me put it this way. Every day I feel like there's a new something that flies around social media or, CNN hyperventilates about it, and then it turns out it wasn't actually a real thing that happened in the White House. So maybe this is lazy, but I've given up trying to see what's happening in terms of the palace intrigue of the White House. But I would say this, for those who are concerned about that issue, this is why it is so important to have checks and balances in our government, right? So, for example, there are things where I disagree with the White House on. We've covered a few of them today. I don't work for the White House, right? I am a member of Congress. We have an independent constitutional duty to evaluate each thing policy by policy and cast our votes accordingly, right? And I think we should all focus on that real substantial legislative work rather than spending our time on the us-weeklyization of American politics.
So the three branches of government are each doing their job, and Washington isn't as in imminent danger as some in social media portray.
Well, I think the advent of social media is a new variable in this equation, and it's changed things not only in politics but in our individual lives, and that's really what worries me. And if you look at sort of the trends among my generation, millennials, and then the next generation, Gen Z or iGen, really they're troubling. There's a great book called The Coddling of the American Mind that digs into this, and it talks about how we've had dramatic rises in suicide, depression, and anxiety among that generation, and they make the argument quite convincingly that it's correlated with social media use. So what we're seeing is people, instead of developing real relationships and real friendships, they're isolating themselves online. The political impact of that is this. The promise of social media is that it was going to bring everyone together, it was going to break down barriers, but it's done the exact opposite. It's allowed people just to self-select into their own little echo chambers. You can live in conservative world and only watch Fox News.
Go to the same sources three and four
totally.
Times
so
an
what,
hour.
What have we lost? And this is what really concerns me in D.C. There's no common ground for an idea meritocracy in D.C. There's no way to have a dispassionate debate without it immediately devolving into accusations of bad faith or you're a racist or you're a misogynist online. I mean, even to just get rid of all the noise and focus on the substance is almost impossible in the modern era where people are profiting, right, both politically and in the media off stoking outrage on both sides.
But the president is governing by tweet. One of his most recent ones was, I have the police, the military, the bikers, and they're not yet playing tough. Things like that, in light of Mr. Cohen's testimony that President Trump would have trouble accepting a defeat in November of 2020, concern you?
I think I will never get used to tweets coming out of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. And listen, as I've said before, Twitter's making all of us stupid, so the less time we spend on it, the better. I think any attempt by either side to stoke their base or stoke outrage just for a short-term political advantage is probably going to backfire long-term politically for this country. And so I'm not telling you I've figured out the answer. Maybe I've screwed up from time to time, but figuring out how we recover that common ground where we can disagree, right? So yesterday I did an event with Mark Pocan. Mark and I do not agree on much
right.
at all. I mean, on healthcare, you know, Mark is Medicare for all, but we don't come at each other from a position of you want to destroy the country. No, you want to destroy the country. It's always with the good faith Wisconsin ethos of, okay, we're in this together. Where do we agree? And if we disagree, let's try and understand each other's perspective. We need more of that.
Okay, almost out of time. Three quick questions. Your response when Ms. Speaker Pelosi told the Washington Post, Trump, quote, is not worth impeaching. Your response to that? I thought that was a bizarre statement.
I don't understand that. I think the reality of what Pelosi was saying is that politically, impeachment would backfire on the Democratic Party. So
okay.
She can invent a justification for it, but I think that's the reality, right?
Okay.
And impeachment, particularly without evidence, would be a complete disaster for the Democratic Party.
Do you expect the Dems to move articles of impeachment?
It's possible. It's possible. I sense there to be a lot of energy on the far left progressive side of that party.
Are they going to carry the day?
In the election?
Are they going to carry the day in terms as House Democrats sort out their future and whether it's going to be run by the Steny Hoyers and Nancy Pelosi's or the Young Turks?
I honestly don't know. I really, really don't know.
What
the last 3 years of being in politics, my first years have taught me is that I should never make predictions about the future.
Okay. My second question then. You serve on the, let me get it right, the Infrastructure Committee. Are we ever going to see an infrastructure bill dealing with rebuilding highways, bridges, et cetera?
Well, we'll have to at some point. What worries me is that, so right now we're in divided government, as we've talked about, but also we have this big black hole that's sucking everything into its gravitational pull, and that is the 2020 election. And so that's going to make it very difficult for us to move big bills like infrastructure. But that committee is actually a source of a lot of bipartisan goodwill, and good work is being done. So even if we don't move a big bill, there may be some smaller pieces of that we can carve out. At some point, we'll have to make an investment. But it gets back to this bigger budgetary picture of if we want to have money for nice things like infrastructure, like defense, we got to get our fiscal house in order. And that's a difficult thing to do. Until people stop demagoguing these issues and spending millions of dollars running ads against people saying, you know, you want to throw grandma off the cliff, it's going to be hard. It's going to be hard to have that conversation.
Final question. Top priority just for the 8th Congressional District in this session, Congressman?
I would say if you look at the needs of the 8th Congressional District, they reflect, I think, what is the top priority in America, which is we got to control health care costs. If we can't control our health care costs while not compromising care and quality of coverage, we have the best health care in the country in Northeast Wisconsin. That's why President Obama came to Southwest High School in Green Bay to give his first health care speech back in 2009.
I remember.
We can lead the way, and if we can figure it out in Northeast Wisconsin, then we can do it in the rest of the country.
If you're as frustrated in 4 or 6 years, are you going to get out of politics?
I will not be in politics for a career, I can tell you that much.
Have you just said you, under no circumstances, would run for Senator Johnson's seat since he said he's not seeking a second term?
The best piece of advice that first of all, I'm too boring. No one wants to listen to me rant about foreign policy and all this other stuff. So it would be hard for me to win any such election. But the best piece of advice that my predecessor, Reed Ribble, who's a great man, told me is don't make a pledge to do a term limits pledge or something like that, because
it limits reporters like me about.
Yeah, don't trust the evil with high reporters. That's what he said. Yeah.
Eighth District Congressman Mike Gallagher, thanks so much
Thank
for
you.
Coming
appreciate
in.
Appreciate it.
Stop back soon.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Thank you.